Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. In the wake of terror attacks in Paris, San Bernardino, and Brussels, it's increasingly common for public figures to equate Islam with terrorism without thinking through the consequences for law-abiding Muslims. But what harm is done when we paint a group with such a broad brush? In this hour, we'll hear from Karima Banoon. She's the professor of international law at UC Davis. And Farana Kara, president and executive director of Muslim Advocates. The moderator for this show is Sara Abbasi. She's the founding board member of Developments in Literacy. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. And now to our moderator, Sara Abbasi.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us. I am Sara Abbasi, and it is my great pleasure to introduce tonight's guests. Karima Banoon is professor of international law and human rights at the University of California, Davis School of Law. She was previously a legal advisor at Amnesty International. Karima has written for several leading academic journals and newspapers and is the author of Your Fatwa Does Not Apply Here, Untold Stories from the Fight Against Muslim Fundamentalism. Farhana Kara is president and executive director of Muslim Advocates. Before joining Muslim Advocates, she served as counsel to the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee, Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Property Rights. She has also worked as an associate with Hogan & Hartson and Ross, Dixon, and Masbach. For those of you here tonight, you can see the program flyer for the full biographies. Please join me in welcoming Karima Banoon and Farhana Kara for a conversation about Islam. So Karima, why don't we begin with you? You've done quite a bit of research on Muslim fundamentalism around the world. Tell us a little bit about your work.
I'd be pleased to. Thank you very much to the World Affairs Council for holding this event. So just to tell you a little bit about how I came to this topic, I always say I didn't choose it. Unfortunately, it came to me, as to so many people in so many families around the world. My father was from Algeria in North Africa, and he was a professor at the University of Algiers. And in the 1990s, with the rise of fundamentalism in his country, he began to be very outspoken, as did so many other Algerian intellectuals. And like so many of them, he began to receive death threats and finally had to stop teaching at the university and move out of our apartment. But he kept speaking out. He stayed in the country. And he kept denouncing the fundamentalists and the terrorists in print, writing things such as the jihadists were trampling Islam underfoot in the name of jihad, and saying basically that they had violated the Islam that was lived by our ancestors. And what really was so disheartening to me in that time was that the terrorists in Algeria were known around the world, but people like my father, who were risking their lives to stand up to them, were not known. And so what I decided to do 20 years later was to go out and meet so many people who are today doing what my father was doing and all of his colleagues, that is Muslims and people of Muslim heritage from within their own communities and countries, speaking out peacefully against fundamentalism and extremism, armed only with their voices and sometimes with a pen. And I wanted to tell as many of those stories as I could. So I wrote this book called Your Fatwa Does Not Apply Here, based on about 300 interviews with people from about 30 countries, from Mali to Afghanistan, and to really try to change the discourse and to bring some of these people more attention. And they're doing amazing things. I think about the victims of terrorism I met who are organizing to support new victims, not giving in to their own grief, but working for others. I think about people who are working against recruitment in their own communities. I tell the story of Abdurazak Bihi, who's a Somali-American advocate in Minneapolis, whose own nephew was unfortunately recruited by Al-Shabaab from his Minneapolis youth program, was taken back to a Somalia that he never knew, and ultimately killed by Al-Shabaab when he tried to come home. And Mr. Behe now, with a shoestring budget, is trying to campaign to save other boys from the same fate. And, you know, you ask yourself again and again, why don't we know these stories? I feel like we have a responsibility to tell them. So that's what brought me to this work.
Great, thank you. Now, in your sort of research and your work, how pervasive is, or how prevalent is Muslim fundamentalism?
You know, I think it's a difficult question to answer in the abstract. I would say that in some places we're talking about it being a very small phenomenon in terms of numbers. In some places we're talking about a much more widespread phenomenon, but especially in terms of changing attitudes, and I think that's what worries a lot of people, the pressure that fundamentalist movements have put on attitudes and sort of even approaches to social mores and so on, the way they have shifted things, the approach to dress and so on, which is radical. Changed since my youth. But this is not at all to say that, you know, terrorism is a widespread phenomenon in most contexts where Muslims live. I mean, it really depends. If you're looking at a place like Iraq, if you're looking at a place like Afghanistan, if you're looking at a place like Syria, obviously there is unfortunately a very large problem created perhaps by a smaller number of well-armed people, whereas in the diasporas, we're really talking about a much more peripheral minority phenomenon, but one that I think can have a dangerous impact on our own youth. And I believe right now we're standing between two fires. We're standing between the fire of the extremism we're seeing on the far right in the West with its anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant rhetoric, and the fire of Muslim far-right movements, the fundamentalist movements. And we can't ignore either one. If you only put out one fire, you're still going to get burned. The challenge is that we have to take on both of these sets of movements. And I do think it's interesting, if you talk to Muslims and people of Muslim heritage from certain regions, from the Gulf and so on, you do get a sense that people are quite nervous about what the rise of Islamic State in particular and the phenomenon of Islamic State means for their own cultures, for their own communities. There's kind of an existential fear of the threat to their own ways of life. And people said this to me again and again. There is a very serious threat, but what must be understood is it's really primarily a threat to us. Right, it's a threat to us here in Muslim-majority regions of the world. And certainly there has been terrorism that has had a terrible impact, but it's been much smaller as a phenomenon in the West or in the North of the world than it has right here in our region. And so what I've tried to do, while taking seriously the impact elsewhere, is to really focus on Muslim fundamentalism as a human rights question for Muslims and people of Muslim heritage and the religious minorities who live with them.
So now, kind of just sort of following up on that, are the incidents of sort of the violent or violent incidents by Muslim fundamentalists mostly in the West? Or have you, you know, is it more sort of globally and then you just sort of hear about those incidents more in the West? Mm.
The vast majority of the victims of Muslim fundamentalist armed movements have, in fact, been other Muslims and people of Muslim heritage, and also now increasingly the religious minorities who live with them, Christians in particular, but Yazidis and others and so on. And I think, you know, we have to grieve for all victims, wherever they are from and of whatever descent they are. That's not the point. But I think it does shift our perception to really rethink who has been on the front lines. I mean, we're talking about thousands, tens of thousands of people dying in places like Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, Syria, Algeria, my father's home country back in the 1990s. As many as 200,000 people, we don't know the exact figures, but as many as 200,000 people may have died from this violence. And it is really unfortunate that that great mass of the victims doesn't get the same press coverage. We don't tell their stories. We don't know their names. And I wanted to try to change that. So one of the stories that I told that really stays with me, I think because I'm a law professor, is the story of a young Algerian woman named Emel Zanoun Zawani. And back in the 1990s, when Algerians were dealing with the violence of an organization called the Armed Islamic Group, which was sort of the 1990s version of Islamic State, that group had ordered that no one should go to school. And Algerians kept going to school. It was a form of resistance against extremism. And Emel Zanoun, like so many others, kept pursuing her studies at the law faculty in Algiers. And in 1997, she was actually taken off a bus at a checkpoint run by this armed group, carrying her school bag, and she was killed in the street. And the people who killed her then said to the other people in the bus, if you go to school, if you go to the university, one day we'll kill all of you just like this. And I think Emel Zanoun knew very well what the threats were, but she was absolutely determined to continue with her legal studies. And she said to her parents, she said, you know, nothing's going to happen to us, inshallah, God willing. But if something happens, you have to know that we are dead for knowledge. And that always stays with me. And I want people to know about those like her in so many countries and communities who have said no to terror and no to extremism.
Very powerful. You started earlier, you talked about sort of your father and how he spoke out so powerfully against Muslim fundamentalists, or rather sort of fundamentalism. So why do you think these voices who do speak out aren't heard from more often, particularly here in the West?
You know, I get asked this question a lot, and I am asking myself the same question over and over again. I think partly these stories are somehow seen as off-message. They don't necessarily fit with some of the narratives we expect, either sort of the narrative we're seeing increasingly on the right, that all Muslims are somehow fundamentalist, or I think narratives we sometimes see on the left, which is sort of preferring to downplay the problem of fundamentalism in the name of sort of speaking out against discrimination. These people are asking all of us on the right and on the left and wherever we stand politically to complicate our stories and to see that, you know, everywhere in the world, people have politics. They're all across a spectrum. They're as different from each other as they are the same, just as people in this society are. And to really respect their individual dignity and not sort of to presume their opinion on any given thing. I think also it relates to what we're seeing, the challenges to journalism in this country and around the world. And it takes a lot of work to tell these stories. It takes a willingness to be out there on the ground, to have journalists who are present finding these stories. And it takes giving the microphone to different people. You know, if you blow something up, if your view is very extreme, you make headlines. If you go to the bomb crater, as Algerian women's rights activists did in the 1990s, the next day, when the ground is still wet from being washed where the human remains were, and you go there and you risk your life and you fill that bomb crater with flowers, unfortunately, somehow your story does not attract the same attention as the bombers. And that's something we absolutely have to change to move forward.
No, you're absolutely right.
Can I just add something to what Karima said? I think she was very articulate about that. And it kind of sparked two points in my mind. And one is something a former CNN anchor once said to me, which is that fear sells. And she said from her experience at CNN that's it, you know, especially when it's terrorism perpetrated by a Muslim, they know they can put that on the air 24/7 and their viewership is going to go up. And that is a reality that unfortunately I think we're facing today. I also think another challenge that we have as Muslims is that we sometimes have challenges getting ourselves out there to be spokespeople. And I actually want to take a moment to thank you, Sara, and the World Affairs Council for actually inviting Muslims to talk about to talk about our community and our faith, because I think all too often the people who are out there on media are other people who are trying to talk about us. And so I think we need more folks in places of you know, power, whether it's in the media, whether it's events like this, to reach out and invite people from the Muslim community to be part of these conversations.
That's a great point. And the Council is a World Affairs is a great, great place. They're doing excellent work. So I wanted to turn to your work, Farhana. So there have been numerous incidents of bias and discrimination and violence against Muslim Americans. In your opinion, sort of what's the source of this bias?
Before I answer that question, Sarah, I want to take a moment to maybe step back and also just educate the audience about who American Muslims are, because I find in my day-to-day work that there's oftentimes some misunderstandings of who American Muslims are. First of all, I think there's a misconception that all Muslims are Arabs. That is not the case. There's also a misconception that all Arab Americans are Christian, are Muslim, and actually most Arab Americans are actually Christian, not Muslim. So we have a very diverse community in the United States, arguably the most diverse racial and ethnic Muslim community in the world is here in the United States. The largest percentage is actually African-American Muslims, followed by people of South Asian descent, closely followed by people of Arab descent. But there's a number of Malaysian, Indonesian, Bosnian, Somali, Sudanese. It is literally practically every country on the earth is represented here. And I think that's important to keep in mind because there are, unfortunately, so many falsehoods and stereotypes that are promoted. Turning to your question and the sources of bias, I really believe that a main factor in what's promoted the bias that we've seen for the last, frankly, 15, 16 years since shortly after 9/11 is a pretty sophisticated network of organizations that we call kind of the anti-Muslim hate network. And it's some organizations and individuals that some of you might have heard of. And if you haven't heard of them, I'm sure you've heard about the effect of their work. It's groups like the Center for Security Policy, Act for America, American Freedom Defense Initiative. These three groups in particular are headed by people like Frank Gaffney, Brigitte Gabriel, Pam Geller. Pam Geller in particular has been running ads in the public transportation systems on buses and subways here in San Francisco, in New York, Washington, D.C., promoting what we believe to be inflammatory messages about Muslims and Islam. And it's this network that we think is actually greatly influencing the public discourse as well as politicians. Whether it's Donald Trump, presidential candidates like Rick Santorum, Mike Huckabee, they're literally taking the talking points from Frank Gaffney and his group, saying things like, Muslims are trying to bring Sharia to America, bringing Sharia to your hometown, things like Islam hates America. These are the talking points of this organized hate network. And what's particularly troubling is that they've not only kind of reached out into Main Street America, but we now have a candidate for the highest office in the land who's basically touting those same absolutely dangerous and false statements. And I just want to mention that a particular issue and I think challenge for us as American Muslims then is how do we counter that? And as we know, I think as Americans is one of the best ways to counter hate speech, bad speech, is to use good speech. And I want to share with you, amidst all of kind of the challenges we've been facing as a country, frankly, with all of the anti-Muslim rhetoric, I want to share a small victory that we had recently. There were two Muslim comedians in New York, Dean Abdullah and Nagin Farsad, who wanted to run some ads in the New York subway system to counter the negative stereotypes about Islam and Muslims and to use humor to educate people about Muslims and who we are. And the New York Subway Authority basically rejected their ads and said it contained disputed political content. Dean and Nagin reached out to us. They say, can you help us? And we basically, with the support of the law firm of Latham & Watkins, who donated their time pro bono and worked with us, we basically sued the New York, the Metro Transit Authority, which runs the New York subway system. And we got a federal court to rule in our favor that basically said that we certainly hope we have not reached that point in American society where simply Muslims talking about who they are and their faith is considered disputed political content, and basically rejected the city's arguments. And just this past week, as a result of that ruling, Dean and Nagin were able to finally run their ads in the New York subway system, reaching literally millions of New Yorkers who ride the subway every day. So I think that is just a small but important victory to allow all Americans, but especially American Muslims, to be sure that we are fully able to use our rights to free speech to counter the bad speech that's out there as well.
Congratulations. That's great work.
Thank you, Sarah.
So you mentioned sort of earlier, and we've talked about sort of the discrimination against Muslim Americans. Tell us a little bit about what impact that's having on American Muslims and possibly Muslims around the world?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. I've been doing this work from a civil rights perspective since even before 9/11. And the experiences we're hearing from American Muslims, from mothers, fathers, in the last few months, it's literally the scariest time for Muslims in America. Just to tell you about a recent text message I received from a Muslim mother of two young girls, 6 and 8 years old. She said, "I am so disturbed. I am truly frightened." As she is absorbing everything that's been going on, all of the anti-Muslim rhetoric, she later told me that her 8-year-old daughter had come home from school and was asking her whether they were going to be deported. And her story is not alone. It's literally on a daily basis now, me and my colleagues at Muslim Advocates are hearing from concerned Muslim mothers and fathers who are concerned about their kids being bullied in school, taunted, harassed, or asking questions like, "Mom and Dad, are we going to be deported?" So this is frankly, I think this has been the most challenging time to be a Muslim in America, and I would say even the deadliest time to be a Muslim in America. Since the Paris attacks in November, we've documented over 80 hate crimes across the country. So these are incidents, attacks on individuals, on mosques, where we believe that the perpetrator was acting out of anti-Muslim hate and bigotry. Even according to the federal government, they believe this is an unprecedented rate of anti-Muslim hate crimes taking place in the country. So this is happening, this is having a very deep, deep effect on the community.
And clearly sparked by sort of this sort of bias, anti-sort of Muslim propaganda. How do we go about changing these perceptions that somehow, you know, all Muslims are terrorists or they're part of some sleeper cell or some terrorist network?
Yeah, well, I think all of us have a lot of work to do. Mm-hmm. And it's not going to be good enough that somebody, you know, makes a friend with a Muslim. But we're really, we are such a small percentage of the total population of the United States. We are only 1-2% of the U.S. population. So there's vast numbers of Americans who don't know a Muslim. They don't have a Muslim friend. They don't have a Muslim coworker or neighbor. It's going to require each of us, those of us who believe in our nation's that founding value, the e pluribus unum, out of many we are one, and that our nation's strength, our growth, our prosperity has been built on the idea that we are all coming together from different racial, ethnic, faith backgrounds, contributing to our country, making it strong, and frankly now taking that extra step and standing up against hatred and bigotry. And I might add that, you know, something that gives me hope, even despite this wave of unprecedented hate and bigotry that's taking place, is seeing sometimes unusual Americans that I wouldn't have expected to stand up and say enough is enough, whether it's former presidential candidate Mitt Romney, Green Bay quarterback Aaron Rodgers. These are folks who didn't, you know, didn't need to stand up, but are starting to stand up and say enough is enough. And we really need all Americans, whatever role you play, if you're a teacher, an educator, you're in a social situation with friends and neighbors, to really start to speak up and challenge those who want to engage in this kind of divisive rhetoric that's not good for the future of our country.
Absolutely right. I've heard you say, excuse me, and I'll quote, that at times of fear, our nation has often overreacted by eroding civil liberties in the name of security, and then later, sometimes decades later, seen the error. In your opinion, how is our nation doing today, and have government officials struck the right balance between security and civil liberties?
We have work to do as a country, and there is a big concern that we have in the Muslim community, and particularly in another area of our work at Muslim Advocates, is addressing the issue of essentially discriminatory policing, racial and religious profiling by law enforcement. And one of our key issues is specifically looking and challenging a discriminatory surveillance program that was put in place by the New York Police Department shortly after 9/11, and we believe still exists in some form today. Under that program, the New York Police Department used undercover police officers, used informants to go into mosques, restaurants, Muslim-owned businesses, onto college campuses, penetrating Muslim student organizations, sometimes even posing as a Muslim student to try to participate in online chats and student activities, not based on any evidence of wrongdoing, but simply because these were spaces where Muslims were congregating. And they did this not just in New York, but in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, on college campuses from the University of Pennsylvania to Rutgers, to Columbia, to Yale, to a number of institutions. And so we and our colleagues at the Center for Constitutional Rights filed a lawsuit against the New York Police Department and challenging its discriminatory surveillance program and basically saying you can't engage in a blanket surveillance program. Yes, we need to keep our country safe, but we also have the Bill of Rights, we have a Fourth Amendment, and the law enforcement needs evidence of criminal activity before it can engage in snooping and surveillance of innocent Americans. One recent point of progress on this issue and what gives me hope for the future is the important role that the courts play in our democracy. And last year, we actually had a very important appeals court hearing and then a ruling in this case. And the appeals court, it was a U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, and they held oral arguments in our case a week after the Charlie Hebdo attacks in Paris. And as you can imagine, walking into the courtroom that morning, I was quite concerned about how the judges were going to view our case. And before this appeals court, it's actually a three-judge panel. And sure enough, it was a second question from the judges' mouths. They asked us, well, in light of Paris, shouldn't the NYPD have this kind of blanket surveillance authority? But by the end of the hearing, our legal team was feeling cautiously optimistic that we would get at least two of the three votes needed to rule in our favor. This past October, we got the ruling from the court, and we got not only a ruling in our favor, but we got a unanimous ruling. And it included, and the court went beyond just looking procedurally at our case, but it went out of its way to include some of the strongest language we've seen to date around this issue of striking the balance between security and civil liberties, and basically made that analogy to other dark periods in our nation's history, and basically said that the NYPD's activities reminded them of the treatment of Jewish Americans during the Red Scare, the treatment of Japanese Americans during World War II, and we should not go down this road again. And so we have that very important court ruling, and we're now back in the lower court, going back to now the discovery and pretrial preparations in that case. So that case isn't fully resolved yet, but we still have work to do, but I am bullish on the future.
It's great.
So just to perhaps strike a slightly different chord on the same issue, although we may end up sort of coming out in the same place, I actually think that there's no one right now who has more to gain than Muslim Americans and Americans of Muslim heritage from good counterterrorism. And I think we have to admit there is an unfortunate reality that there are movements out there which are seeking to prey on young people in our communities and target them for recruitment and involve them in awful lawful illegal activities. And unfortunately, we do need government to stand up and take a stand and adopt policies that are going to be able to help us protect young people, not by discriminating, not by profiling, but unfortunately sometimes by engaging in robust counterterrorism. And I shudder to think of what the consequences will be in the current political environment for not only Muslim Americans, but anyone who can be confused with them, because we know Sikhs, for example, very often are the victims of what is in fact anti-Muslim bias. You know, I shudder to think what will happen if, God forbid, there is another terrorist attack carried out here by Islamist armed groups wrongfully claiming to be acting in the name of Muslims. So I do think it is absolutely appropriate to critique counterterrorism where it gets that balance wrong between liberty and security. But I also think we have to refrain from critiquing anything that government might do to take on this problem. And, you know, in human rights law, I teach international human rights law, states actually have an obligation under human rights law to what we call both respect and ensure human rights. Now, students sometimes think that this is a redundancy, but if you look at counterterrorism, if you look at the issue of security and liberty, it actually isn't. It means vis-a-vis non-state armed groups that states both have to protect people from other actors harming their rights, that is, ensure their human rights to protection from terrorist violence, and at the same time, they have to respect rights. They can't violate rights while they're doing that. And the problem is that on the security side, very often people only talk about ensuring rights, and on the human rights side, they only talk about respecting rights. And the challenge is that governments have to do both of those things. So I think at the end of the day, we might agree, but perhaps we're emphasizing different things. And I think both sides of the coin, avoiding discrimination and profiling, but also taking security seriously and finding rights-respecting ways to promote security in this current environment are both critical.
Great points. And that was going to be my question to you as well, is what, in your opinion, would be ideal U.S. policy around this issue? I don't know if you want to add anything else or you feel like sort of, you know, you've addressed that.
I mean, I think that's a much bigger question, and we have to sort of step back and look at a number of decades of history. I mean, one of the things that the United States really needs to do is be very careful who its partners are in the Muslim majority regions of the world. And the United States made a strategic alliance with Wahhabism and a particular very virulent form of Islam used as the sort of ruling tool now in Saudi Arabia, and that Saudi Arabia very actively exported around the world. People in many places that I went, Muslims in places like West Africa and South Asia, were complaining bitterly to me about the impact of this. And, you know, these were U.S. allies that were engaging in really exporting this ideology. So I think we have to think very carefully about that. And I think very often the U.S., and not only the U.S., but some other Western countries, think that the thing to do now is to sort of partner up with what they call the nonviolent extremists, the people who might be promoting discriminatory views of women or even of religious minorities, but they're not engaging in terrorism against Westerners. To me, this is a catastrophic mistake, and what we actually need to do is find productive and thoughtful ways to support the people who are actually challenging fundamentalism within their own countries, within their own communities. To me, those are the real moderates, and that would be a much more useful strategy.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Karima Banoon, professor of international law at UC Davis, and Farhan Akera, president and executive director of Muslim Advocates. They're in conversation with Sara Abbasi. She's the founding board member of Developments in Literacy. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. The World Affairs Council is a nonprofit membership organization. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org to share this episode, to register for upcoming events, or just to join the World Affairs Council. And now back to our conversation.
And I would say, Sara, that a couple of things come to mind that I think should be guiding principles for our country going forward, and what we certainly advocate for at Muslim Advocates. And one is an adherence to our nation's founding values and the Bill of Rights, First Amendment, Fourth Amendment, among them. And enshrined in those rights is, I think, exactly that balance that has served our country well since its founding, the principles that guide law enforcement, the day-to-day, following legitimate leads, following using credible intelligence, not engaging in broad brush assumptions, guilt by association that applies to entire groups simply based on their race or ethnicity. When we've gone down that road and gone away, gone astray from those fundamental values is when we've gotten ourselves into trouble as a country. And I think so long as we and our law enforcement authority focuses on the leads, that's what's going to keep us safe. And it's not just me as a civil rights advocate saying that, but there's a number of former intelligence and national security and FBI officials who've gone on the record complaining about essentially the overconsumption of information by the government, particularly since 9/11, where it's now even challenging at times for law enforcement to basically find a needle in a haystack. There's been so much information that's just been literally vacuumed up from electronic-related surveillance and other types of surveillance. And so I think what's going to keep us safe is like if law enforcement can stay focused on legitimate leads. And there have been a number of unfortunate terrorist incidents where it was later determined that there was some indication that the person or individuals were of interest to law enforcement, and for whatever reason, potentially because they are over inundated by going too broad, that law enforcement did not follow those leads and go deep. And I'm thinking namely here of the Zarnav brothers who perpetrated the Boston Marathon attacks and the guy, the so-called underwear bomber. These were people who were on the radar of FBI and the CIA and fell through the cracks, so to speak. So we need law enforcement in our intelligence agencies to be focusing their energy on the bad guys and not going overly broad and bringing in innocent Americans and others.
Thank you. So we've been collecting questions from the audience, and I'd like to bring them into our conversation. So this one is, has it been difficult to have hate crimes against Muslims prosecuted as hate crimes? Mm. Farhana, I'm guessing this is...
this is a great like question. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a great question. You know, as folks may know, there is a federal hate crimes law that as a result of an additional law that was passed and signed into law by President Obama a few years ago, there's now a pretty expansive federal law that protects against hate crimes targeting people based on their race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, faith. But at the state level, where most crimes are investigated and prosecuted, it's more of a patchwork. And just to give you an example, there, as you may recall, there was a horrific murder just about a year ago in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, in which a guy killed three Muslim students, Dia Barakat and his wife and sister-in-law, Yusor and Razan Abu Salha. And under North Carolina law, there is no hate crime for murdering somebody. So state and local authorities aren't really interested in the motive of the killer. They're just interested in prosecuting the guy who murdered them. The family, on the other hand, understandably, because there was a history of interaction between this guy and their children, they know that this guy was engaging in harassment and anti-Muslim bigotry directed towards them, and they want a hate crime investigation. They want to get to the bottom of this. And so we've actually been working with the families, going to the federal government and saying, look, to seek full justice for the victims and their families, we need a federal investigation. And that is something we've been continuing to press and advocate for. And there have been a number of other incidents in which we've asked the federal government to get involved and investigate. And there have been a couple of cases now in which they have not only opened investigations, but have now brought federal charges, and there's dozens more where they have opened federal level investigations. So slowly but surely, we are getting traction. The Attorney General has made a very strong statement and commitment to countering anti-Muslim hate crimes, and so we are continuing to be hopeful that we're going to have the federal government support.
Can I jump in on this? I think one thing that's important to remember is also that Muslims and Muslim Americans and people of Muslim heritage are sometimes dealing with hate from multiple directions. And I think about, for example, Muslims for Progressive Values, which is a wonderful organization based here in California that performs same-sex Muslim marriages and will perform marriages for a Muslim woman to a non-Muslim man. And some of the hate that, unfortunately, they have faced from Muslim fundamentalists sort of within our own group has been a real challenge. And they very heroically have taken a stand both against discrimination in the broader society against Muslims, but also that kind of homophobia within our own community. And I also think about complaints that I've heard, say, from students up in Davis about things that some Muslim clergy have been alleged to say about religious minorities within Islam, including the Shia. And as we know, there's a lot of terrorism directed right now in a range of places, whether it is Pakistan or Iraq, against people for being Shia. So students were very concerned about some things that were being said. And again, finding themselves in this very awkward position of feeling like they are facing sort of general, perhaps, misunderstanding from a broad sector of society and having to stand against that, but at the same time having to challenge some hate speech that may be emanating sort of more internally as well. And it seems to me that we have to really be attuned to and sensitive to both of these kinds of hate and really challenge both of them.
There are a number of questions around why don't more Muslim leaders speak out about extremists like ISIS, Hamas, Hezbollah? Why don't leaders take sort of more of a prominent role and stand up against violence?
I'll take a stab, and then you want to take a stab, Karima. I think you will hear a lot of American Muslim leaders, certainly community members, who will, when they hear that question, they usually breathe a huge sigh of frustration, because I think a lot of American Muslims feel like they do condemn it, and on the one hand, they do condemn it and condemn it repeatedly, but there is this falsehood that's promoted that Muslims don't condemn terrorism. And then I think the second reason for the frustration is that when a non-Muslim engages in an act of terrorism, there aren't the same calls. So when the guy, Dylann Roof, murdered 9 people at a church in Charleston, South Carolina last summer, you know, there wasn't broad calls for all white people, all Christians, to condemn this racist act of terrorism as well. So I think there's broad opposition and condemnation. It's not always unfortunately heard.
Mm-hmm. So my answer to this is a bit complicated. What I would say is that on the one hand, there are many people who have spoken out and no one has paid attention internationally to what they have said. And at the same time, not enough of us have not only spoken out, but really taken on the issue. It's very easy to condemn attacks after they happen, but taking on the ideology systematically that is leading to those attacks, you know, I think that is something that many, many more of us need to take on. And so just to give you some examples from both sides of my answer, the first with regard to people who have spoken out, there's been tremendous courage shown by people in sort of frontline situations. And I think about one religious leader, and I heard a lot about him when I was in Pakistan working on my book research. His name was Mufti Sarfraz Naimi, and he was from a particular school of Islam in South Asia, the Bareilvi school. And he, back in 2009, chaired a meeting of Muslim religious scholars who denounced suicide terrorism. And he said very openly, those who commit suicide attacks for attaining paradise will go to hell as they kill many innocent people. And he then himself was felled by a suicide bomber a few months later. And we don't know about him. We don't remember people like him. And I think that is a terrible shame. We should be honoring the memory of those who have spoken out. And at the same time, I have heard from so many from Pakistan, from North Africa, calling on those of us living in the diasporas in relative safety, please, to be more outspoken and to find ways to be more supportive of those who are doing this work back home. Because the fundamentalists have a lot of international support, and their democratic opponents don't necessarily get that. So yes, many people have spoken out, but also many more of us need to not only speak out, but to act on those words. And I know it's very popular to sort of say, well, there's a double standard and we're not asking other people to speak out. I have to say personally, when I see a Jewish American speak out to criticize the policies of the Israeli government, say, that may violate human rights, I am very grateful to that person for doing that. And I feel a similar responsibility when these armed movements are wrongfully claiming to act in the name of Islam and committing atrocities. I really want to speak out. I'm appalled by the thousands and thousands of people they're killing. And I think about sort of the impact on the beautiful culture, one of the two cultures in which I grew up, you know, the impact of these movements. Why would I not want to use literally every breath I have to condemn what these movements are doing? That's my view, which is perhaps a little bit different. It's not the same as to say that people, there's collective guilt, and if people don't want to speak out and this doesn't matter to them, they don't have to. But it seems to me that we can do a tremendous amount of good, both in terms of supporting the opponents of these movements, but also in terms of challenging the bigots here, if we make sure not only that we're heard, but that we're acting on those words.
There are a couple of questions on sort of the rise of fundamentalism and how much of it is based on sort of the writings of the teachings of Prophet Muhammad or something in the Quran. Either one of you sort of want to take that?
I'll defer to Karima on the, as a scholar on the fundamentalist movements.
I think this is a really tough question, and here's my answer is a bit of a controversial one. What I say is, really, in the world, there is no such thing as a religion of peace or a religion of war. Religions are what people make of them, unfortunately. And there are many wonderful teachings in Islam about peace, about honoring the views of others, unto you your religion, unto me mine, about dignity, about respect, about rules for the conduct of warfare. When I was a student, I did a study on, there's an argument that Islamic law actually contains many of the precepts that later, many years later, crystallized into international humanitarian law for the protection of people in times of armed conflict. All of that is true. Unfortunately, just like with any religion, whether you look at the Old Testament, whether you look at texts in certain other religions that can be interpreted in certain ways, you know, there is also, you find also the opposite of some of those things. And you find text which can be considered much more bellicose and sometimes even discriminatory. And it is about how you interpret it. And I think the really heroic work is being done in all faiths by people who are trying to interpret religion in a humanistic way that is appropriate to the challenges of our century and is respectful of human dignity. And so I think Muslim fundamentalist violence is, for me, a product of a particular politics. And that politics is called Islamism. And Islamism is not the same thing as Islam. As I say in the book, the three extra letters make a very big difference. Here we are talking about, in my view, far right-wing political movements that are misusing a very extreme interpretation of religion as a tool, not for spirituality, but to take power and to coerce people. And it is those movements that we have to challenge. Now, for the most part, and I heard this from many of the activists that I interviewed around the world, the strategy to challenge these movements needs to be a political strategy. Now, can also sort of positive interpretation and reinterpretation of religion play a role? Certainly, I think that is definitely true when you look at the broader social impact of these movements and the way they tap into perhaps things that people are hearing in religious schools and so on. But I think when I look at this, this is first and foremost a political struggle against the extreme right. And let's face it, unfortunately, in the world at the moment, there are a lot of such political struggles that need to be undertaken.
Farhana, I think this one is addressed to you. You mentioned a federal law against hate crimes and a patchwork of state laws. Mm-hmm. Law in the books is one thing, enforcement is another. Mm. Can you speak to this sort of?
Yeah, so that raises a great point, which is that there's a tremendous amount of discretion, basically, by prosecutors, by law enforcement agents, about whether they'll actually take a case, investigate it, actually bring a prosecution at the state and local level, and that's particularly true at the federal level, and that's been a particular reason why we've been, part of our work at Muslim Advocates has been actually advocating with folks in the Justice Department all the way up to the Attorney General to ensure that the federal government is investigating and prosecuting cases where the facts are certainly there to bring criminal charges. So that's absolutely true.
So this question is about our relationship with sort of Muslim allies. Do our politics, you know, sort of how is it undermining sort of our work fighting radicalization, fundamentalism around the world? The relationship that we have with a number of our allies. I know Karima sort of mentioned some of the work that we've done, some of the communities you mentioned, sort of Wahhabism, the spread of Wahhabism by one of our sort of biggest allies. And so our work against fundamentalism being impacted because some of our biggest allies are, in a way, sort of promoting some of that.
So my father was an anthropology professor, and he always used to try to explain to me that the problem of fundamentalism in the Algerian context had both endogenous and exogenous causes. And as a kid, I had no idea what he was talking about, and I later came to understand he meant both internal and external causes. And I think that's absolutely true. Part of this problem is coming from sort of organic issues within Muslim-majority regions of the world at the moment, and part of this problem is coming from and certainly has been exacerbated by the policies of a range of other actors, including the U.S. One of the spectacular mistakes that the United States made here was to decide that Muslim fundamentalism was a good ally against communism back in the context of the Cold War. So, for example, in Pakistan, we supported the Islamizing dictatorship of Zia-ul-Haq because he was seen as a bulwark against the Soviet Union. The consequences of that for Pakistan, for its neighbors, were absolutely tremendous and tragic. I think it was a very short-sighted policy. Another one was in deciding to support basically any armed group, no matter how extreme it was, that was fighting the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. So we not only supported the Mujahideen, who were sort of nationalists, who were opposing and understandably opposing the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, but often we were supporting some of the worst militia groups, Hizbi Islami, headed by Hekmatyar, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, a really murderous warlord, for example. And there was also support both from the U.S., the Saudi government, and the Pakistani intelligence services, allegedly, to support jihadis who came from many countries in the Muslim-majority regions of the world to fight in that so-called jihad against the Soviet Union. They got training. They came home. In Algeria in the 1990s, we used to call the worst of the terrorists the Afghans because they were people who were veterans of that particular conflict. So this is only one aspect. I don't think we should sort of focus this all on a critique of U.S. policy, but I think for Americans, you know, it means we have to think very carefully about the consequences of our policy choices in the region. And I was very worried after 2011, the revolutions of 2011, that the U.S. again was sort of making the deal to work with fundamentalists in the region. It looked like there was a fair amount of U.S. Support in some quarters, for example, for the Muslim Brotherhood, which was being battled by democratic opposition groups across North Africa. And there are long-term consequences for people in the region when we make those choices. So we really have to listen to the voices from the ground, I think, and try to make better choices.
This is a question. Why is the term Islamic terrorism used? Why don't we just call terrorists terrorists? I believe the ways the two words are combined together really affects the mind of the uninformed person who doesn't know anything about Islam.
So my kind of thought about terminology, I do think words matter. And use terms like radical Islamic terrorism, which I know is a favorite phrase of Senator Ted Cruz right now, and some of these phrases I actually think are very problematic because I think it feeds into the narrative of these groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS who want this to be a religious war, a holy war of the U.S. versus Islam. And I think we're better off if we call our enemy who they are. We call them ISIS, we call them Al-Qaeda, but not engage and basically feed their narrative of this idea that it's a war of the U.S. against Islam.
I don't have any problem if people want to be specific, but then they should think and speak with great precision. The term Islamic terrorism, I don't particularly understand. Islamist terrorism, I absolutely understand, and it is a term that is actually used across North Africa by the opponents of these movements all the time, and it refers to, again, these far right-wing political movements that are employing this particular form of terrorism. And you will hear that term, you'll hear the term jihadist terrorism in the region all the time, and as there's a great Algerian terrorism expert, Lies Boukra, who wrote, jihadism is not jihad. Jihad is a doctrine in Islamic law. It has many different meanings, some of which can be very positive about sort of internal struggle and how that is the highest jihad that there is. But jihadism is a particular version of this doctrine that has really been sort of mutated by these Islamist armed groups and used for their own purposes, often turning actually many of the mainstream interpretations of Islamic law on their heads and practicing what is called takfirism, which is where you basically excommunicate other Muslims so that you can legitimately, quote unquote, kill them. And I actually think it helps to be specific, to use the terminology that identifies the politics of these groups. It's just, they're not just Muslim or Islamic. That to me is really imprecise and entirely inaccurate and goes back to some of the generalizing that you have been talking about.
So maybe we'll end on sort of a positive note. A few questions on what have other religious groups done to address the issue of Islamophobia? There's a couple here on what can other communities do to kind of help the Muslim sort of community and other individuals to kind of bridge this gap, kind of reaching out to our Muslim neighbors and sort of build community and greater understanding.
Yeah, there are, so I'll kind of answer, it was kind of like a combination, but I think mm-hmm. a couple of those questions, Sarah. I think there have been a number of faith communities and other communities that have been stepping forward because I think they do see they do understand what's at stake and the mm-hmm. importance. And there have been a number of folks from the Jewish community, different Christian denominations, the Sikh community, Hindu communities, who've been stepping forward. Groups from the Interfaith Alliance, Bend the Arc, the Anti-Defamation League, different interfaith groups, even at the local level, regional levels across the country, have been really stepping up and work with us on a regular basis as well. So there's certainly an opportunity for folks from different backgrounds to be stepping up.
Now, what about sort of on an individual basis? Any kind of sort of suggestions before I turn it over to sure. Karima?
That's a great question. I think it's one thing at the individual basis kind of that comes to mind was something I was saying earlier about really taking it on when you see it in your own network. So whether it's on your Facebook feed and you see friends who are engaging in this kind of hate and bigotry, you're in the workplace talking to having the water cooler conversations, things like that, and really kind of taking that step. And then in terms of if you want to engage organizationally, some of the organizations that I named, for example, like Bend the Arc, which is a kind of a reform Jewish-oriented action organization, has a number of action campaigns right now geared towards some of these issues that we've been talking about. So that might be one way for engagement. And then again, a number of different organizations at the local level, national level, whether it's through the interfaith groups. And then I might add also on the progressive on the progressive side, political side of things, there are groups from Credo to Move On to Demos that do have ways for people to engage online, and they are getting increasingly activated and animated on these issues as well.
Great reminder. I'd like to take a moment and say goodnight to thank our radio listeners and thank Karima Binoon and Farhana Kara for this excellent discussion.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. This program featured Karima Binoon, professor of international law at UC Davis, and Farhana Kara, president and executive director of Muslim Advocates. The conversation was with Sara Abbasi, founding board member of Development and Literacy. Please visit World Affairs at worldaffairs.org. This broadcast was made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Additional funding for post-production is provided by Maria Starr. She's a member of the KQED Producer Circle. Our recording engineer is David Ogilvie. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.